Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Carla Sezenko, Editor-in-Chief at Time Out New York. Starting out as a freelance journalist, Carla joined Life and Style Weekly in 2005 and worked her way up to managing editor and held the same position at In Touch Weekly. She became deputy editor at Time Out New York in 2014 and was appointed editor-in-chief the year later. In her role, she appears regularly on NBC, Fox and PBS, talking about the best things to see, do, eat and drink in New York. As well as her work as a journalist, Carla is a prolific creative writer. She's author of the play Headcase and her writing has appeared in Marie Claire, Jezebel and Gizmodo. Carla, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, what an amazing career you've had so far.
Oh, thanks. I mean, yeah, it sounds really impressive when you read it all off in a list like that. But, you know, it's just my life.
So let me start. This sounds overly flattering, but I do mean this, right?
Oh, okay.
I think you have the best job in the world. New York City is the greatest city in the world.
Agreed.
Time Out is a fantastic magazine, one of the best in the world. You're editor of it.
Yes.
Isn't that the most amazing combination of factors?
I think so. Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, I don't think it sounds flattering. It just sounds, although I appreciate it, it just sounds sort of factual. I mean, I'm a native New Yorker, so I agree that New York is the best city in the world. I have some other favorites, but that's my number
one. I live in Milton Keynes in England. You wouldn't know that, but it's not as good as New York.
Okay. I mean, I'll take your word for it. I do love London, though. I think London is actually the only other city I've met that is at all like New York. There's something very similar about it in terms of the culture. And you guys close a lot earlier than we do, though.
I work in London. Our office is in Covent Garden, so where I have the best of both worlds, really. I live on a farm in the country, and then I also work in Covent Garden, so best of both worlds.
Tough life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I would agree with you that I have one of the best jobs in the world. Yeah.
Did you always want to be editor of Time Out New York? I mean, what was your evil plan at the beginning?
Oh, God.
To take over the world?
I mean, yes, I'm still working on that one. No, I remember when Time Out New York launched in 1995. I was a freshman in college and this amazing thing had come along that kind of was all about my favorite city. And so I think in a kind of dreamy way, I would have loved to have worked here, but I'm a late bloomer in everything I do, and I never really, it took me a long time to figure out exactly what I wanted. And I think even when I got the gig, I think it still didn't seem quite real. I come from a journalism background in a way. My dad was a reporter for McGraw-Hill for years and years and years before striking out and starting his own newsletter company in DC. So my whole life, he was commuting back and forth from New York to DC on the Amtrak. He used to see Joe Biden sometimes on the train, which is like one of my favorite things ever.
Love Joe Biden.
Who doesn't love Joe Biden?
He's only got a few weeks left as well, hasn't he?
Oh my God, please.
I got it.
Well, no, he has a little more time than that, but he's like killing it right now. This is not on behalf of Time Out New York. This is on behalf of Carla Sezenko Joe is the man.
We love Joe.
Love Joe. But so journalism, I was always a good writer. I always loved writing. And when I went to college, so my dad's a journalist and publisher. My mom is a retired teacher, had a very kind of liberal artsy kind of house. You know, my parents were taking me to the theater all the time. Culture, dance, all of that was really, really important to them. Certainly didn't grow up in a house where the dream was like, you're going to become a doctor, which was never going to happen because I think I had to take my chemistry midterm like three times when I was a junior in high school. But
well, you're already on a loser there. It's biology, surely.
You have to take all of them, though. You have to take orgo. You have to take everything. You have to take all the sciences. I'm pretty sure if you like don't pass chemistry, they're not, you know, you do amazingly in bio. They're not like super psyched about you being a doctor.
We do things differently back in Britain.
Oh, yeah. It's cool. They're okay if you don't understand chemistry. But
I should
anyway.
Say to our listeners, actually, we're here in New York. We're actually recording this in New fantastic York. New York.
Yeah, it is fantastic. I hope you guys get to stick around a little bit and like take advantage of everything that's amazing here. I happen to know an amazing publication and website that can help you figure out the best stuff to do in New York.
And what is the specific website address of said website?
That'd be timeout.com/New York. Yes.
Anyway, back to your education.
Yeah,
at this point, you were still uncertain about what you wanted to do.
I was. So I went off to Boston University and I immediately declared as an English major, which I think was a mistake. I would have loved to have been one of those people that kind of went in undeclared and just let kind of the spirit move me and figure out what I wanted to do. But I declared English and that was cool. And, you know, it was what I knew how to do. I knew how to like deconstruct literature and write essays about it. But what was great about BU, so BU is made up of all these different colleges and they have this great program called BUCOP, which is a collaborative degree program. So you can basically take a major from one school. And if you can figure out the way to like get all the credits done, you can add a second degree, basically. So I ended up, because of my dad's background, I think, and because I always liked writing, I was like, well, journalism surely is a good fit for me. So simultaneously with getting my BA in English, I added this BS in journalism, which I think is hilarious that that's what it's called. But I ended up with these two degrees. And I will never forget.
I know what BS means because we watch American television.
It's right. So Bachelor of Science, yeah. Right? But it sounds hilarious when you say it. So I remember my last semester of college, all of my closest friends were either off to graduate school or had their first jobs. And I was, for the first time in my life, kind of, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was terrified. And I remember a journalism professor basically asking everybody, are you going to go into journalism? And if you're not, like, raise your hand, let's talk about why. And I raised my hand and I was like, I don't have the fire in my belly. I knew I didn't want to be a beat reporter. I didn't want to work at a newspaper. And I just didn't know what was open to me. I just didn't see journalism as my future.
And you didn't see it as a, because I mean, some people are attracted to journalism because of the kind of Woodward Bernstein campaigning.
Yeah, that wasn't me.
Bring down the establishment.
Yeah, I wish that it were. I don't think I have the chops for that necessarily. I'm not a reporter, really. I really came from a writing background. Like, I loved writing.
I'm not bothered by corruption, frankly, so let me get on with it.
You would love it in the States, then. Not that you guys don't have your own.
All power to Richard Nixon. You know, he's only trying his best.
Okay. So, so I kind of got out of school, and I was a little lost for a little bit. And I ended up, I was really, really fortunate that I had parents who were like, look, you want to write? Go to graduate school. Write. And so I ended up getting my MFA in creative writing, which, oh my God, that was like such an idyllic time. I always joke that not that I ever thought grad school was hard. I didn't. But like, in terms of, you know, woe is me. But sometimes I laugh. I'm like, I can't believe there was ever a time when I thought like a day spent like reading Derrida and like trying to figure out what that meant was difficult. So that was amazing.
And you obviously enjoyed the creative process of writing.
I did. I loved the workshops. I loved the reading. I loved, you know, I was working on, that's where I worked on my play Headcase. That's where I started it. And then it ended up in the Fringe Festival and I got to work on short fiction and I got to meet amazing authors. And it was like 2.5 years of me kind of finding myself and realizing, okay, yes, this is, I want to write. While I was there, I ended up kind of applying for, you had to take this pedagogy course, and if you made it through and then you applied, you could potentially get a gig as an adjunct professor. So I ended up doing that. I was an adjunct professor of writing and literature. And then when I finished my program, while writing, while actually working on creative stuff, I was like, oh my God, I don't want to go through what I went through after college. I don't want to, you know, come home and flounder and not know what I'm doing. I'll just keep teaching. And so I kept doing that while trying to work on creative projects. And then,
because writing is quite a solitary exercise,
totally,
isn't it? My
totally.
Wife's a writer. She's got a novel out and it is quite a lonely.
Congrats.
Yeah, she actually, when I said I was recording this today, she said, oh, I'll listen to that one.
Oh, so that's nice.
But it implies she's not listening to the others.
Oh,
anyway,
it does. Yeah. Well, early. Nice for me, not for you.
But it is quite, you know, the solitude is there, isn't it? It's quite a lonely endeavor, isn't it, writing?
That's exactly right. So the thing I would always say is, when I was an adjunct back in New York and I was writing, there were still, so this was like 2002, 2003, there were still coffee shops around, like the kind of central perky Friends ones. And basically any day I wasn't teaching, I would go to this one coffee shop, DTUT on the Upper East Side, and it was just wall-to-wall freelancers and writers. There were just comfy chairs. And like, until I got there that day, I wouldn't have spoken to anyone. I would have woken up in my apartment and probably done a little writing there and then get out. And the way that I think we all dealt with the solitariness is that like we created this space for all of us. And so I would go there and I would work on a novel that never came to be, you know, as most novels don't.
It's tough. It's tough.
It's, you know, super tough.
I've been there while my wife wrote her novel, and it was tough just watching it.
Yeah.
Never mind doing it.
It's incredibly hard. And something, I think the solitariness kind of finally got to me, and I loved the time in the classroom, but otherwise I felt really isolated. And then I was like, hey, wait a minute, didn't I want to work at a magazine at one point? And it was like this light bulb went off, and I found this ad for this little magazine called New York Moves, which was a really beautiful looking magazine. I think you can still get it. And I came in as an EA. I was making a $400 a month stipend, Luckily, I had other freelance gigs. I had really supportive parents. No, I mean, it's not livable. It's not livable by any stretch, but I got amazing experience because it was this tiny little team. And not only was I writing, I was meeting with photo editors to look at their books. I was scheduling shoots. I was dealing with publicists. All of a sudden, I was getting all this like on the ground. Like I said, I was a late bloomer. A lot of people.
Kind of building your network.
Exactly. And it was helping me figure out what I like to do. And, you know, like, people in New York publishing, I feel like, or at least I felt like, maybe it's changed a little bit, there was a really specific track. You know, you wanted to get in at a Condé or Hearst, and you wanted to get in on the ground floor, and maybe you got a fashion marketing gig, or you were working in the closet, or you were, you know, something on one of the lower, kind of the low end of the totem pole, and then work your way up. And I hadn't done that. I was off in graduate school. I was coming in late, and so it gave me amazing experience. And then what it really did was when it was time to leave there, because I couldn't afford to stay, and it was absolute insanity, but kind of a good kind, the kind you can do when you're in your 20s, I started looking around for other jobs. And I remember I interviewed for two. I went, there was a newspaper job in Queens, and I ended up basically spending the entire interview convincing the guy why he shouldn't hire me, which is definitely like, just
was this some kind of clever reverse psychology move?
It really wasn't. Right. It was like a self-deprecation, self-sabotage kind of thing, which I do, which is awesome. I'm working on it in therapy. But basically, I was like, you need a reporter. And he's like, no, listen, you can do it. And he ended up trying to talk me into taking the job. The same time, I found a copy editor gig at Life and Style Weekly. So Life and Style Weekly was relatively new at the time. It's a Bauer publication. So Bauer's obviously huge, you know, in Europe. And it was kind of in the midst of the celebrity boom. And they were looking for a copy editor. And, you know, I happened to get in at the right moment because I think a year later, they wouldn't have hired anybody that didn't have really hands-on copy editing experience. But I took a phone call with the guy, with the executive editor at the time. And it's like, oh, yeah, I've copy edited. This will be great. And I remember hanging up and calling my friend who at the time was the copy chief at FHM. And I was like, hey, Randy, I was like, what do copy editors do? She explained to me what they did. And I was like, that's perfect. A grammarian, you know, I'm a grammarian. I can polish things, you know, and that's kind of what got me in there. And little by little, I found myself like back on the journalism track in a way that made sense for me. And copy was the perfect way to start because as a copy editor, you can really kind of keep your head down. You know, I didn't have a beat. I didn't have to know what was going on in celebrity journalism.
Well, you're clearly in love with the words and it got you access to them.
That's exactly it. And then it's amazing. I was there for a bit and my editor, Samantha Myler, who's now at Nickelodeon, and my editor-in-chief, Dan Wakeford, who's now at People, kind of saw something in me that made them want to pluck me out of the copy department and kind of get me involved in some other things in a way that wasn't quite so separate and so head down. And then that was kind of it. I was on a new track and kept on going.
And you felt that you were on the right track at this point. You had just had a sense of purpose.
I did. I mean, I'm the kind of person who I like going to an office every day. And so even more than the work itself, it sounds so insane. Even more than the work itself, which I did love, I liked that I had a purpose every single day. And I liked that I had a community of people after feeling kind of so isolated for so long as a freelancer and as an adjunct. And so, yeah, once I was in the magazine world. And, you know, it was, again, I don't think I could do this at 39, which is how old I am now. But when I was in my late 20s, you know, on the copy desk, I would sometimes be there, especially when I was promoted to managing editor, because I was simultaneously managing editor and still on the copy desk. So there were days I would go in at 10 a.m. and not leave until 3 a.m.
Wow.
And
it
was a long day. And then we'd have Tuesday off and I'd walk around like a zombie. And that's the day you do all your errands and stuff like that. But yeah, once I was in it, I was kind of sure that I'd landed in the right place and was no longer really questioning my path.
So then did you already have an idea where your path might lead at that point? Do you think, right, I'm on this track now and it's going to end in global domination?
No. Yes. No, I didn't. Am I dominating globally?
Yeah, well, you are now.
I'm not. Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I don't. In a weird way, I'm a super planner and I'm super OCD. I would say in terms of my life and where it's going, it takes other people to point out what they think I can do. And again, this sounds so cliche, but it's kind of like hard work and talent, but then luck has been the third. I mean, I think it's for anybody. But so, yeah, it was those two people at Life and Style, Sam and Dan, and then most significantly, it was Terry White, who's now the editor-in-chief of Empire Mag.
And coming on this podcast in a few weeks.
Is she?
She's
okay.
Lovely, Terry.
So she, I mean, I really credit her with seeing something in me that I didn't know I had. And so because I'm the kind of person who is often, it would have never occurred to me to think that becoming editor-in-chief of Time Out New York was even an option. It wouldn't have even crossed my mind because it's so effing rad.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so basically what happened is Terry had come in as executive editor, Life and Style. I was still managing editor, though my kind of scope of responsibility had grown a bit. I was coming to lineups meetings. I was coming to the run through of the mag. I was giving my input beyond what a managing editor, and of course, managing editor and publishing is different at every single magazine. It's one of those roles. All roles are different, but I think that's the one that kind of fluctuates the most.
It's like the title executive producer on TV shows. No one actually
those are all
quite
writers.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you'd never know it.
Or
but
it could be a vanity credit. You never know.
It could be, right. Yeah. So for me, my job as ME was primarily, my main goal was, and at this point, I was managing editor of Life and Style and In Touch. It was getting the book out the door, hitting our deadlines. We had insane deadlines. We had hourly deadlines. So I was walking over to people and ripping galleys out of their hand and saying,
I'm exhausted,
we had no more time.
Picturing it.
It was exhausting. I mean, I was running around in like really kind of, you know, idiotic heels, like pulling pages away. But I loved it and tracking things. But then the place where it had kind of grown in scope was that because I had editors who believed in me and who valued my opinion and knew I was up on fashion and beauty and a little bit on celebrity, that they and, you know, had thoughts about the design of a page and knew how to break down a story, they started to ask me for more of that stuff. And so when Terry gave notice that she was leaving, it was her idea that I apply for executive editor. And I was like, no, what, are you kidding me? No, absolutely not. And
it was very nice of her.
It was incredible. I mean, she believed in me. And, you know, so Dan Wakeford ended up taking me on in an acting capacity as executive editor. And it was an amazing experience for me because what I learned was that there were certain things I was incredibly good at. I could edit a story like nobody's business, but it made me realize, and I think this is something I always kind of knew in my gut when I was a copy editor, is that if you are going to be the person that is deciding what stories go in the mag every week and editing them, you really have to have an affinity for the content. I don't think everybody does. I think that there are some people who can disconnect themselves enough that they can work on any kind of content. You know, I once interviewed for a job at The Observer, and the man that I interviewed with was like, well, how, what do you feel? What about running our tech vertical? And I was like, I don't know anything about tech. And he was like, you don't need to. You need to be a good reporter. You need to this. You need to that.
You do. Your heart needs to be in it.
Your heart needs to be in it. And so that was kind of the disconnect for me when I got to the level of executive editor in Celebrity, because I was like, I can't tell you which Khloe Kardashian story is better to run this week. They both sound horrible. Like, I'm the wrong person to judge.
Was there also, because we've spoken to quite a few people who follow their career up to the point where they become editorial and the leadership team.
Yeah.
And they say that there's a lot of kind of human resource and legal issues and things, that stuff that they, you know, that's all completely necessary in a program, but it's not, the heart's not in it, and you end up getting bogged down in stuff that there's no joy in it.
What kind, like the deal, just dealing with your team?
Yeah,
you
like
mean?
Human resources, legal issues, editorial.
I don't
know,
mind that stuff.
Well, you are editor.
Yeah. I mean, I think that probably comes from, I mean, it's why I enjoyed being an ME. I mean, I think some people ascend to a point, you know, I'm guessing that Anna Wintour is at a point in her career where she's probably not line editing every single story that goes, or she might actually, I don't know. I mean, she's an amazing editor.
There's
and has
so many
gotten
different
to a
styles.
Place. You never know.
There's no one way to edit.
For me, I don't mind that side of things. I don't really find it to be an annoyance. And I have to say, with the direction of media and kind of the size of editorial teams, I don't think there's anybody in any position that's not doing a little bit of everything at this point.
So back to your career. So
yeah.
Your heart wasn't in choosing which Kardashians.
It wasn't.
To show.
It wasn't. As much as I loved Life and Style and I loved the people I worked with, leaving was actually really difficult. But I was kind of at the point where I was trying to figure out what my next move was. I didn't know, you know, I didn't think I wanted to stay executive editor at a Celebrity Weekly, but I didn't really think going back to being an ME was an option at that point, because this whole new world had opened up to me. It was like I had seen what was out there and I hadn't quite found the right fit, but I knew that there was something else that I should be doing. And the timing worked. It was really fortuitous. Terry ended up getting hired as editor-in-chief of Time Out New York, and then she brought me on as deputy. And that was my dream job. That was the dream job that I never really knew that I wanted. And
who was her predecessor? Did Tim Arthur come out and set it up?
Tim Arthur was
a former
CEO.
Podcast guest.
I know.
And
I've
a friend
listened,
of mine.
I've listened to that podcast. I love Tim Arthur. He's a lovely person.
He's a ledge.
Michael Martin, I believe, was the editor in chief before that, with John Shannon doing a stint in the middle, maybe, I think. So I never worked with Tim when he was editor in chief. When I worked with him, he was CEO.
So Terry's like your guardian angel then. Are you going to be the next editor of Empire? Does she move on when she eventually becomes God? Do you like move to the Jesus position? How does it work?
I'm Jewish. I don't know. Will they let me be Jesus?
He always was.
I think my place is in New York, or at least in the States, I would say. There are certainly other cities that I would be happy to edit in or from. I think eventually I'll always come back to New York. But yeah, no, it was a fantastic fit.
And you knew straight away that that was the job for you.
I did. I really did, because it ticked every box for me. It was a publication that I knew and I loved and I'd read since it started. It was at an amazing kind of critical time for the brands, because Terry had come in and made all these amazing changes to the magazine, really reinvigorated it. You know, the site blogging was kind of like the amount of strides that we've made in the digital world and social and video and all these things that were kind of just like a flicker in the eye of Time Out and in media in general in the past couple of years were kind of all coming to a fore at that time. And I got to spend all day long basically sitting around with editors and graphic designers and photo editors and thinking up ideas for stories, sometimes writing the stories when I wanted to or when they were assigned to me, editing. And it was, yeah, it was a dream. And
so
I didn't even think I wanted it
as work.
I did think of it. It's really hard work. I mean, it's the best. Anytime I interview anybody for a position, I tell them, I'm like, it is the most fun you'll have and the hardest you'll ever work. It is intense, but it's worthwhile if you enjoy it. So yeah, I definitely did think of it as work, because, you know, I'm a perfectionist and I want to make sure it's not a hobby. You know, we needed at the time to sell magazines. Now they're free. We still want to move them. We still want people coming to our website. We still want people associating the Time Out brand with really cool stuff, because we think we have a ton of it. But so, yeah, I did think of it as work, but just like the best work I'd ever done.
Did you have a secret eye on Terry's position at this point? Did you think, well, she's eventually going to get an even
Absolutely
better
not.
Job
and no.
when she's ready, I'll move in?
Nope. I never had aspirations to be an editor-in-chief ever, 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 ever.
And yet here you are.
Yeah.
How did it happen then? How did you become the big cheese, the grand enchilada?
Oh, God. Terry told me that
was
she
it like
was...
the end of season two of House of Cards? Did you bang twice on the desk when... remember when Francis became president? Spoiler alert, by the way.
I don't watch it. Oh. Could you please make a Real Housewives of Orange County reference? That would make sense to me.
I've heard of Orange County.
Oh, it's California. Yeah. It's amazing. It's ridiculous. It's wonderful.
That's what the OC means, doesn't it?
The OC, that's right.
Well.
That's exactly right. No, Terry told me she was going to Empire. And
that's quite a move for her. I mean, literally crossing the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she'd done it a couple of times. She had, you know, been an editor-in-chief in London and then come over to Life and Style and then gone back and then come back and then go back.
And she's on the podcast herself in her own right, so we won't make this about Terry, we'll make this about you.
That's
so
right,
there
but,
you go. So she's gone.
But she did have a kind of crucial hand in my career, so I don't mind talking about her.
Well, she's clearly spotted the talent that you have.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it was her idea that I apply for it, and I was basically, and she said to me, you're not going to be Carla about this, because she'd seen me go through it with the executive editor position. And I, you know, I don't necessarily think self-deprecation is a terrible thing if you can use it in a way to motivate yourself. You know, once I take something on, I will fight and fight and fight and tell you I can't do something. And then once I do it, I'm going to do it better than like I ever thought possible. And so it became that kind of thing where Terry was like, you should do it. And then my executive vice...
under promise and over deliver. It's actually a good strategy.
I guess it is. It's not a conscious one. But between Terry and my executive vice president, Justin Etheridge, who also believed in me in a way that I didn't in myself, I was just terrified by the position because she had set a high bar. This was kind of like the absolute like pinnacle. Like if you had picked one publication and brand that I loved more than anything else, this was it. And so to hand over the reins was a tremendous amount of pressure. And so I was terrified. So no, it was absolutely nothing I ever even thought of. And now it's been about a year and I just like thank my lucky stars that I'm doing it. And I just feel so fortunate. And it's just the best. It's amazing.
So I'm going to ask you a question now about what your typical week is, but you're not allowed to reply. There is no typical week.
Okay.
Or just invent one. let's create an amalgam of the general job and condense that into a generic typical week. What's a typical week?
A typical week, I'm in about 40 meetings back to back. We do have a lot of meetings. Yeah, no, there are a lot of meetings. So my typical week is kind of, so there is like actual editing where I am getting paper galleys. We still use paper. My last job, we didn't. Everything was in a CMS, and that's the only way you'd ever see it. So I'm editing. This is kind of, in a weird way, went from being the biggest part of my job as deputy to one of the smaller parts of my job just because of the additional pressures of being an editor-in-chief. So I'm editing galleys for our features for the entire book and making sure I see everything at least once, which is fewer times than I would like to, but I'm a control freak and I have to deal with that.
You've got a lot of other stuff to do.
So that's kind of like the bare bones, just like getting the mag out the door kind of stuff. I'm meeting with my deputy editor. So my deputy editor, Andrew Zimmer, who's amazing. He worked at Thrillist before he was the New York editor over there. He supervises our digital team. Every morning they have a blog meeting where they're discussing what blog content's going to go up for the day, who's going to do it. When I can join that meeting, I do. I spend a lot of time on calls with the team in London, whether it's the editorial team. This morning we had a call with the editors in London and Lisbon to go over just... We basically each said, like, video is working really well for you guys in London. Can you talk about your strategy behind that?
So there's like a culture of sharing best practice.
Exactly. Right. So we had that call this morning. I spend a lot of time on the phone with our marketing team in London also. I spend a lot of time in meetings with our marketing team here, along with our edit team, to plan content for coming months. Spend an increasing amount of time dealing with our creative solutions team. So that any project that they're out there kind of promising to a client is on brand and has a timeout tone and we think is appropriate for us. I deal a lot with the events team. We have an increasing number of amazing events. And so same thing. Basically, everything is content in a different way. And so if we plan an event, it has to be appropriate for timeout. The way we sell it on our site, the way we kind of write the copy for the tickets, it has to be a timeout event. And so we're all kind of communicating a ton. There's an exec team, which is basically all of us that are kind of at the highest level at our respective departments, whether it's edit or commercial or strategic partnerships or product, whatever it is. We kind of meet every week and just talk about highlights, lowlights, things that are happening in our world. God, what else? I have features meetings where we sketch art and plan digital stuff for our features.
Management, isn't it? I mean, I know that sounds naive given that you are the editor, but there's a lot of management.
A lot of management, which is it's one of my strong suits, I think. That's the part. I think it's the part that a lot of people kind of dread, and managing a team is one of the things that I really enjoy the most. Getting to talk to my editors, getting to talk to people in other departments, and kind of realizing we all have the same goal, which is that we just want timeout to be kind of as dynamic and amazing as it can be, and doing our individual part to do that. So
and it is an amazing brand. I mean, we don't have to be neutral here. We can be a partisan podcast. Love Time Out.
Yeah.
It's genuinely a fantastic magazine.
Oh, thank you.
And it takes itself seriously, even in terms of the leisure and everything that it does. It does very, very well.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was listening to Tim Arthur's podcast, actually, he kind of said it right on, which is that, you know, we have people who are a mix of critics and journalists, and our whole thing is about inspiring people. We want people to pick up the magazine or go on the website or go on our app and find something amazing to do, or a cool new restaurant or the best new cocktail in town. And, you know, the way that we're doing that is expanding. It's no longer just about the magazine. You know, if you want a cool cocktail, you can go onto our Facebook and we have a video of one of the best bartenders in the city making you a cocktail.
But I can also go into a bookshop and buy a Time Out book, Guide to New York.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not merely just a website and a magazine. It is an iconic media brand.
It is. And now, you know, one of the things that we're kind of expanding really rapidly now is our e-commerce. So now the thing is, instead of coming to our website, reading about something, and then having to exit the site and go buy a ticket to something somewhere else, you can do that on our site now too. So that's a really exciting development for us also. So.
What, do you get the best invites? I mean, surely there must be some perks to being editor-in-chief of Time Out New York.
You know what's so funny?
Do you get to go out with Kiefer Sutherland or something?
I do. I'm meeting Kiefer Sutherland right after I leave the studio. No, I mean, I get a lot of great invites, for sure.
Oh, but you turn them down, dear.
No, what I was going to say...
Anna Wintour of you.
No, yeah, no. I feel like the vertical editors get better ones in a way, because I think that the publicists and the artists out there know, and they're right, that they are the real arbiters of their world. So, like... Our music editor knows the music world way better than I do. Like,
so he gets the best invites.
Yeah. I mean, I may be at the top of the masthead and I get plenty of invites. You know, I'm not a loser sitting over here with nothing to do. but I do think that people have caught on to the fact, and I think this says a lot about our brand and kind of our subjectivity, our informed kind of curation of stuff, that if you want to get something done, first of all, plan an amazing event. Do something great and then get it in front of the vertical editor and let them be the judge. And if it's great, they will just publicize the hell out of it. They'll put it in the magazine. They'll put it on the website. If it deserves its own blog post, they'll do that too. But I'm almost like the funnel. You know, if something's amazing, if something's huge, if it's cover talent, for the most part, our features editor, Tim Lowry, deals with that stuff because he's fantastic at it. But if there's something big, then yes, then I'm getting those emails. But if it's like, hey, we just launched this amazing party at Mr. Sunday, like they're going to get that in front of our nightlife editor and our music editor because they know that they're the ones who are going to be able to vet it.
I work in PR and I've seen some really bad press releases because we're on the various media databases of this podcast. So I receive crap press releases.
Yeah.
But do you get kind of spammed with stuff which is utterly inappropriate?
I do.
You think, you know, that might have stood a chance if you'd have sent it to the right person, but I'm not going to be spammed.
I get a lot. The thing that drives me crazy, a pet peeve of mine, is when it's clear that people haven't really read us. I'm never going to need an expert on like toenail fungus. Like we're not going to do a feature on that. And basically what that does, that publicist has done him or herself a disservice because I will probably remember that name. Maybe. I mean,
you
there's
might even
a lot in my head.
Right click and add to spam.
I haven't done that yet. That feels a little aggro, but okay, maybe I'll start.
I have a lot of journalist friends that deliberately take themselves off the media databases.
Yeah.
So if you want to know the showbiz editor of the Daily Telegraph is, it doesn't tell you who it is because they don't want the emails.
Yeah, I get a lot of stuff that's just completely inappropriate. And to me, that's just super lazy. Do your homework. Don't send, you know, 1,000. I mean, I understand. Or if I get something to the wrong name, that's like a pet peeve because I'm looking at it as a journalist. I think that there needs to be a little bit of attention to detail, you know, but I get a lot of crazy, crazy press releases that have no business at Time Out New York. Yeah, I do a lot of deleting.
And do you give them like a one-liner? Do you say, I'll read the first 6 words and then it's delete?
Yeah, pretty much. Sometimes it's the subject.
Because you might even have that anxiety where you think it could be an interesting
story.
Well,
that's the thing, right? You're worried, did I just delete the best pitch ever? Yeah, no, I sleep okay at night. I think I'm a pretty good judge.
This sounds a bit sycophantic, and I don't mean it this. And it also sounds a bit cliche and trite, but...
I can't wait.
Do you feel like you have your finger on the pulse of New York more than, say, the average person does? Because clearly you must know what's going on, where all the coolest parties are. I know that question sounds lame, but...
No, it doesn't sound lame. I think I do more than the average New Yorker. Although there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. I mean, our food and drink editor, Christina Izzo, always says, she's like, my least favorite question is like, where should I go for dinner? And I get that because
McDonald's.
Obviously, yes. You know, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't turn my nose up at McDonald's.
No,
but
I
think, yes, I think I am tuned in to a lot of what's going on in New York, probably more than the average New Yorker. But there is a lot to know. And I think, you know, I depend on our vertical editors a lot in that realm too, you know, and so I would say I have my finger on the pulse more than the average person. But there's always a lot to learn.
Just before we talk about your play and all the various other interesting things you're doing, your stand-up comedy, I'd like to ask an interesting kind of industry question, because Time Out has obviously gone from newsstand paid for to free. You huge pushes online via the apps and all the various other brands. Tell us about that in terms of how you're innovating within the space, because Time Out could have just died a slow death. The newsstand numbers, if you hadn't have innovated, it could have just gone into slow decline.
Yeah.
Clearly, you guys are very aggressively and very assertively, and rightly so, stopping that and actually taking advantage of the brand strength that you have.
Yeah. I mean, I think I can answer that in a kind of general way, which is that...
Good, because it was a really crap question.
No, it's okay. It's just, I think basically what it is that I think everybody who works at Time Out from the, you know, way tippy top of our executive team down to the bottom. I think everybody really loves the brand. And I mean it. I mean, that sounds like a very kind of like press releasey kind of thing to say. But I do think that's what
stands
makes
for
people. It really does. And it's been, I mean, it's a legacy brand at this point, you know? And so I think that nobody wanted to see it die a slow death. I think that would have been heartbreaking. I mean, obviously, we see amazing publications folding left and right, and it's heartbreaking if you love magazines and you love media. And so I think that there was no other choice. And I think that everybody saw that there was a serious opportunity there, because the things that we're doing, in a way, are no-brainers. I know that hindsight is 20/20, but the fact that we would have an app, the fact that we would start selling the things that we're touting on our website, the fact that we would, you know, make a concerted effort to blog more and share the knowledge that all of our editors have in a really newsy kind of constant way really makes perfect sense. And so I think that Time Out just adapted with the times, because the alternative, I mean, it was really not an option for anybody. I mean, we're all so in love with this brand that I think that that was just kind of like a foregone conclusion. That
do you have a kind of a reader in mind when you're putting the magazine out? Can you visualize him or her? Is he or she in their late 20s and works in IT and goes jogging around Central Park? How specific are you?
That's him. That's it. That's our one reader.
Because some editors do actually have a kind of fictional person in mind that they're aiming their journal at. And then others say, no, we just put it out.
No, I mean, I don't think that's true. I don't think anybody just, I think everybody considers their audience and who they're reaching and who they want to be reaching that maybe they're not. I think, you know, I think we have a diverse readership. I mean, I think, you know, we tend toward the millennial set because they are the ones who are going out and want to know how to spend their money. And, you know, if they're going to go have dinner once a week, they want to know the best place to go and do it. But we have, you know, we also have people who, you know, people like my parents who are really avid theater goers who have been reading David Cody and Adam Feldman's reviews since way before I started at Time Out New York. And they live for those. And so I think that our audience is they're, you know, regardless of the age or the gender, I think they're all smart. They're all tuned in. They all want to know exactly what's going on in New York before anybody else does. We have a very specific tone. We're not snarky and we're not mean, but we have attitude. We're New Yorkers. That comes across in the copy. I think that kind of like goes across all Time Out properties, regardless of the country or the city. We're a little bit irreverent. I think that that's what we keep in mind. I think the most general barometer is, do we think this thing is cool? Do we think people should know about it? Do we think they'll want to go to it? And do we have something potentially exclusive or a little bit secret on our hands, you know? And
it's what you want, isn't it?
It's what
a reader.
You want. That's what they want. Our readers freak out whenever we give them anything that is at all exclusive so that they can, you know, sit around with their friends and be the first to tell them that they found out about this bar that operates behind a secret door at the back of this restaurant. You know, we live for that stuff.
Let's just step outside the editor's chair for the moment and tell us about this play that you've written.
So I was 24 years old and I was in the process of getting my MFA at Emerson and I took a playwriting course. And it was initially, I thought playwriting was going to be a piece of cake because I'd seen so many plays, I'd grown up going to the theater, I'd never acted. I don't know what made me think that I was going to be able to do it, but I took this playwriting course with Betsy Carpenter, who was a dramaturg who'd worked with David Mamet and William H. Macy. And it was one of the most intimidating experiences of my life. She was incredibly tough. And it took me a long time to get the hang of writing. And I finally seized, I mean, I was, you know, I was in my 20s and I seized on this idea of writing a play that like takes place in a therapy session. At this point in my life, I'd never been in therapy. I don't know what gave me that idea. And I wrote like 40 pages of it about this girl that basically the concept was she's in a therapy session. She's trying to figure out her life and her therapist is making her feel like she's crazy. And the way that things worked was that actually when I saw Privacy recently with Daniel Radcliffe, there was a scene that reminded me of this. I'm not suggesting they stole it from my Emerson manuscript. But
listen, she is suggesting
it felt very familiar. Basically, what would happen is the therapy session gets more and more kind of surreal and insane. And so she and her therapist decide to order pizza, which as someone in therapy, I can tell you is not a thing that happens ever. But basically the pizza arrives and the pizza delivery guy stays and he becomes part of the therapy session. And she's talking about her sister and she enacts a scene with her sister and then her sister stays. And then eventually her entire family is kind of on stage with her in this kind of like increasingly Looney Tunes session. And so I'd only written 40 pages of it. My best friend, Amy Jilks Lowe, who has worked at Manhattan Theater Club for years and had a bit of a directing background, was like, well, what if we like try to do something with this? And so we worked on it together. So this was in like 2000. This is a while ago now. And we submitted it to The Fringe and it got in, which I was incredibly like just awed and amazed and shocked about. And
what was that like to see it on stage?
It was crazy. I mean, even before seeing it on stage, we were in rehearsal and I had this one scene that I'd written where this guy and this girl are kind of like fooling around on a couch. And I turned to Amy and I was like, they're doing this because I said they have to. It was like this, I was drunk with power for the first time in my life. It was unreal. We had six performances and, you know, it was a crazy experience. I was 24. I think I'd be mortified to go back and look at the play now and you know, see how I wrote it. But it
would
was
you do
great.
More? Would you write more plays?
I'd like to. I mean, there are a lot of things I'd like to write. The trouble is finding the time, which is like really, I have very little of it. But yeah, I'd love to try another play. I find it very intimidating. I think the act of playwriting is just, it's such a phenomenal skill. And whenever I go to the theater, whenever I see a good play, I have like a kind of what feels like the reverse reaction that you should have. When I see a good, like a bad play, I feel really inspired because I'm like, this person got this play produced. It was horrible. I can definitely do better.
There's hope for me.
Exactly.
We all think like that, don't
we? When
I
see a phenomenal play, I feel really, really overwhelmed and like I should never try to write another one, but we'll see. I don't know.
What's next for you editorially? I mean, clearly you've only been in post a year or so. I imagine you'll want to stay there for 20 years, but there must be something to come next. Will you take Terry's next job and become editor of Empire?
I don't think so. I don't know exactly. I'm really happy where I am right now. So I'm not really thinking ahead at all beyond just like trying to make time out as great as possible, getting better and better talent to work with us and, you know, just creating as many dynamic products as we can. I'm not there yet. I mean, I'm a little baby editor in a way. I mean, a little baby at almost 40, but, editorially just to make time out as good as it can be is my goal, really.
What advice would you give to someone starting out a career in journalism? So go back to say when you were 18 and you were a slightly more ambitious version of yourself who wanted to get to editor of Time Out New York by age 30.
Exactly.
What would you say?
I would say work really hard is the first thing. And don't think any job is beneath you. And don't discount where a job that seems like it's completely out of left field could potentially take you. Because I think that the way to get to your ultimate goal has become a bit more diversified, I think, as media has. So I think you could get a job doing one thing that seems completely unrelated to that thing, whatever you decided that brass ring of a job is, and you never know how you're going to get there. So if a job feels interesting to you, or if it's at a publication that you respect, or it's at a website, maybe not doing the thing that you thought you would be doing or that you ultimately want to be doing, don't discount it. I never would have predicted that I would get to my position via the route that I took. And I don't think it was traditional, but I don't think that you have to have a traditional track. I think that you still can. I don't know what journalism students are, you know, learning in terms of what their first job should be now. And I also don't think you need a journalism degree to work in journalism. I mean, that's kind of one of the most important lessons that my father taught me as a journalist. You know, if you are inquisitive, if you are hardworking, if you ask good questions, if you have curiosity, I think if you work hard and you keep your mind open to the different kinds of jobs that you can have, especially now, the fact that, you know, you can get a job in media purely working on a website. There are so many website only brands now. I mean, it's funny to even say because that wasn't the case when I was
BuzzFeed
getting out of school.
Springs to mind.
I mean, BuzzFeed
is
an amazing
brand.
Example, right? So
doesn't actually exist in the real world, does it? It's paper.
Not in the tangible world. Yeah. So I think that would be my advice and just work your ass off. Just don't nothing. And I would say this even to people who have gotten pretty far in their career. I think that nothing is beneath any of us, you know, just work really hard and always, always look for opportunities that aren't kind of right in front of you. Other ways for you to get involved. If, you know, that's one of the things, not to make it all about time out, but one of the things that's great about the way we're structured is unlike a, you know, some behemoth publishing company where your job is your job and that is all you do and you don't talk to the other departments and you don't touch their work. We have people, if, you know, I've written, when I was deputy, I wrote film reviews for film on occasion because I was interested in a particular movie that they were screening and they needed a review written. And so look for other ways to get involved. Look for other things you can be doing. Always put yourself out there to be the one to volunteer for stuff. I think that that would be my biggest advice.
Right. Last couple of questions then. Penultimate question.
Yes.
Listeners won't realize this, but I am genuinely hilarious.
Yes, and no, they'll realize.
They don't, because I'm a kind of more serious version of myself. I have serious media in industry questions.
Okay, but, he's hilarious.
But in real life, I am highly hilarious, yeah. Right? And I've often been tempted to try a kind of open mic night at like the comedy club. But the problem is, though, is if I cracked a joke in a party, no one laughed, I'd move on. It wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
But if I went on stage and cracked a joke and no one laughed, I would just kill myself.
Oh, God forbid.
So how did you do? I mean, tell us. You obviously tried, you know, dipped your toe in the water with stand-up comedy.
I did.
That, to me, is the only thing in life I'm actually scared of and won't do.
Yeah.
So kudos.
Thank you. I would say I can't speak to what it feels like to bomb because I killed. I was so good. I started as an assignment for Time Out New York, learned to do stand-up comedy. Maybe more things should occur to me to try. I don't know. I like depend on other people to suggest things.
What was your first thought? One of, I'll nail this straight away.
No.
Right. It was fear, was it?
The first thought was dread.
Right. Good.
I really like public speaking. I really like being on camera. I really like, you know, I'm a very social person. So the idea of getting up on stage didn't scare me. The idea of having to write a set terrified me, even though I'm a writer, because comedy writing is such a specific kind of thing. And I mean, granted, I was in a really fortunate position because it was for a story. I was able to get a really wonderful stand-up comedian, Bonnie McFarlane, to work with me. So I basically wrote a set. It was fortuitously right after a breakup with my boyfriend. So I had tons of material. It was incredibly cathartic. And she helped me punch it up. And
he wasn't in the front row, was he, on the first time you delivered the performance?
No. Uh-uh. No. It was amazing, though. It was so great. So I mean, I've seen people bomb. I'm sure if I tried to write another set, maybe I would. And that's probably why I've only done it twice, because I don't want to try to write another set. And I'm a really stubborn person. And I have this thing, which is like, sounds crazy to say because I depend so much on my team, but I always feel like I can't take credit for something unless I do it all by myself, which is like a bananas way to look at life. But because Bonnie helped me punch up that set, I never felt true ownership of it, even though I was the one getting up on stage and delivering it. So I think if I were going to write a second set, I would make myself write it all by myself. And then I would definitely up my chances of bombing, I think, which is probably why I haven't done it. But I think it was super edifying. Like, nothing feels better than hearing people laugh at you standing up there and like being funny and self-deprecating and making fun of your jerky ex-boyfriend. Like,
were you an exaggerated version of yourself, or were you you?
Let's see. I don't think I was exaggerated. I think I tended to be like I was going to say pervier. That's not true. I'm like plenty pervy, but I like definitely, I went in a direction on stage that I don't think I expected of myself. Like I told like a couple sex jokes, I guess. I wouldn't call them jokes, anecdotes. So it was a slightly different version of myself.
And we should tell our listeners that the set is on YouTube,
it
isn't
is.
It? I'll have to Google you.
Yeah, if you Google me, the performance was at Caroline's on Broadway. You can find it. I think Carla Sisenko stand-up would probably do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, how I became a stand-up comedian in 19 days was the story.
And is the article itself online still?
It is, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I shall read and watch both.
Okay, thank you.
So, final question then. In the intro, it said that you do a lot of, like, TV punditry. How did you get into that? And why do you do it? And what do you say? I'm obviously a Brit. I only come to New York once a month.
Yeah.
So I've never seen you do any punditry.
Oh.
So what kind of punditry
do
you
do? Up my punditry. Is that a word? Punditry? I'm going to start using it.
We have professional pundits in Britain.
Well, pundit we have, but we don't have the noun, like the act.
Punditry, yeah.
You know. The field of punditry.
It's a profession now. We have a group of about 30 ex-politicians in Britain that all they do is like the paper review on certain rolling news channels, and they
we
pop
have those
up
too.
And, yeah,
yeah. It started because of Time Out, and all my TV work has been with Time Out. So basically,
so you're introduced as the editor of Time Out New York.
That's exactly it. So I will go on TV, as will a lot of our editors, and you know, it was sort of like a self-fulfilling thing. Once we got a couple of TV spots, we became known as really kind of like the source of anything happening in New York. So I have, for example, I used to be on Pix 11, which is a local station, every week talking about the best stuff to do for that weekend. Once I became editor-in-chief, obviously, I'm pretty busy. So now our two fantastic editors, Will Poulos and Jillian Anthony, go on and do that every week.
It's good PR for the magazine, though.
It's fantastic PR for the magazine. And it lets people know that if you have a question about something to do, we are your source for it in every way, shape, or form. So I'm on NBC every month talking about the best things to do for the coming month. Our Things to Do editor, Jen Picht, is on every Thursday talking about free and cheap stuff to do for the week. Frequently, you know, we had this amazing event last year called Dough Fest, or earlier this year. So I basically went out with a reporter from NBC and we tasted some of the best donuts in Brooklyn. I mean, that was a really hard day for me.
Yeah,
exactly. Get to run around eating donuts and being on TV. You know, we have...
What do you do in the evening? Just lay there and suffer from hypoglycemia?
Lie, moan. Yeah, just like regret
everything. But it was
everything.
Still worth it.
It was fantastic. So we basically... So anytime... We have kind of our standing segments that we do. And then really anytime a news channel basically is in need of a source, is in need of someone who can come on and really speak to. And it happens also not just with stuff to do, but with trends. I've done some stuff with Fox 5, with Arthur Chian. You know, he'll read a study about dating in New York and he'll call me up and say, hey, can you like talk about like the single scene in New York and what it's like to date and places that you think people should go to date? And so we'll film a segment about that. So we've really become, especially in the past year, you know, all of our staff, we're on TV a lot just because we're inside New York and we can really talk about what's going on here. So
do you like it? Do you like being in the studio? The red light goes on.
Oh, it's so fun. I get a real thrill out of it. So
Carl, I've really enjoyed that. It was super, super interesting. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to be interviewed.
Thank you for having me.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!